had me tight, they thought. So today I start out by saying Jesus Christ Superstar is a problem, and I feel that's got me in hot water already with certain age groups. I structured anything for this afternoon on this. Technically we'll be operating for an hour, but we can operate for more than an hour. Some people can only be here for an hour. And I'm perfectly open to do anything you want to do, talk, listen, so on. The primary reason why I set this session up this afternoon is because there were some young men from the Old Village staff that were a little unhappy about the way we handled this last week, so I set it up and left it completely open. And I don't think any of them are here. So, at least not yet. So at any rate, we can handle it any way you want to handle it. In addition to this, I asked Rosie, who's just coming in here, to bring along the composition which Weber and Rice did just before Jesus Christ Superstar, which is about the Old Testament figure Joseph. I thought if you were interested, we might be part of that, and if you're familiar with Jesus Christ Superstar, you might see some similarities or differences to it. Three or four people here I know have heard it. All tell me it's not as good as Jesus Christ Superstar. I haven't heard it, so I'm going to hear it later on this afternoon if I don't hear it with you. So at any rate, I am open to handling it any way you want to handle it. If it's any inducement, there are three recorders going right now, one of the three of which is the official Holden Village recording machine. And if you want to be, if you want to be immortalized, feel free to talk this afternoon because you'll get recorded. I don't know if this is general knowledge, but one of the, I suppose it's Holden Village Extension School that this is an operation of, but a great many of the presentations which are made here out of the village are recorded, and then they're made available to churches, various other kinds of groups, I think on a rental and purchase basis, for purpose of stimulating the discussion or something of this sort. So if you want an opportunity for immortality, and feel free to talk this afternoon and you'll get recorded, and then if somebody writes in, like for instance, your lady's aid and wants a discussion on Jesus Christ Superstar, you know, you can kind of casually say, there I am talking. Not for the commercial. What would you like to do?
I think I should tell all of you
that the
rest of the remarks
before me,
not the final
sentence,
because I usually erase all my tapes.
All right, one of the three tapes is under. Like Mission Impossible will eradicate itself. Okay, now that we've taken care of the electronic side of the business, we are prepared to play anything you want from Jesus Christ Superstar and Stereophonic Sound. My girl Friday is at the back of the room, ready to go on anything you want. We had a run-through last week. It worked out great and discovered that she can almost instantly play anything you want. So we can handle it any way you'd like to go. Depends on what you're doing. Is it illegitimate to quote from a book?
No, but the thing is, you don't get the full impact of the whole thing.
No, I'm simply suggesting that, you know, we may happen to want at a given point in the discussion to illustrate something or other to play a particular piece. I mean, that's part of it. Mm-hmm. Okay. There's no substitute for listening to the whole thing. No, I agree with that. Okay, what would you like to do?
Isn't Bill Williams talking about these spaces?
Before that, I want to know what you never had before, and what was the big question?
I didn't, never did get too clear about it. About the only thing I got on it was I was informed that I was doing it all wrong, right in the middle of the of the evening. I guess there was a kind of a feeling that one should not talk in an analytic fashion about something like this. That's an interesting opener.
I think it's probably the same thing about not knowing the community.
No, well, Bob, I'm not reflecting. I know Bob's feeling about it. No, I'm not. It wasn't Bob that talked to me.
Why do you think that I think it's a problem?
It's a problem. Oh, that's a good lead in. It's a problem because if I had these people here exclusively, it wouldn't be a problem, and if I had you exclusively, it wouldn't be a problem. But the fact that both of you are here, it is a problem because I think what younger people want to do at a session like this may very well be totally different from what older people want to do at a session like this. I think what, for a great many older people, the primary question about Jesus, the first question about Jesus Christ Superstar is it theologically correct? And I suspect that the first question of a group of young people getting together to talk about it would be, does it turn you on the way it turns me on? Is that accurate? I can talk better for older people than for younger people.
You know, I'm turned off. The first place is you talk about problem and you're trying to analyze somebody else's problem. You turn it up there and down here, and you're giving them, you're analyzing their problem. You forget a problem. You're taking in as part of the problem.
I thought I just described it.
Well, I didn't think of it. I took it as you kind of analyze your problem.
No, my problem is the fact that I have got, with respect to this particular item, I have got two distinctly different audiences with distinctly different interests, some of which have. So the problem is how you handle this hour.
This is your problem.
Yeah, that's my problem. Yeah. That's why my opening remark was Jesus Christ Superstar is a problem for me as the leader of this session right now. And the more people come, the bigger the problem gets.
Hi. We have completely different things in neighborhoods, but that's not
oh no, it's got nothing to do with taste. Nothing at all to do with taste. But taste has nothing to do with the question that most older people would ask, is it theologically correct? This is absolutely nothing to do with taste. Now I think maybe what you're kind of leading to is, if I put it in another way, when older people confront this, the first thing that they tend to look for and to watch is it or is it not theologically respectable? And when younger people get involved with this, I think it's in the area of aesthetics. And you have an aesthetic reaction to it. This has been my experience in, you know, various people I've talked to. And church people, I think, particularly Lutherans and more particularly Protestants, have a great deal of difficulty in distinguishing the aesthetic from the ethical and theological. And it just makes problems even greater for me because when I get involved in a situation of functioning as arbiter, I have to I have to explain to somebody who may be very worked up about the item. We are talking in the area of aesthetics right now, and what you are doing is talking about theology, or you're talking about ethics. I'll give you an example of what I mean. About a week before we came out here, my parents stopped by of a Sunday evening to see us, to wish us well. And this album was sitting out on the dining room table, and we were chatting there, and my wife happened to mention casually to my mother that it's a kind of unusual age in which we're living. Our little two-year-old twins know Jesus Christ Superstar, but they don't know Jesus Loves Me, This I Know. This is a kind of an interesting concept, perhaps on our time, perhaps on our household. But at any rate, she asked my mother whether she would like to hear some of it. And my mother's reaction was, I don't need to hear any of it. I already know that it's blasphemous. That it's blasphemous. And I said, well, how do you know that it's blasphemous? And she said, well, you can tell from the title. And I said, well, why don't you listen to some of the music and see what happens? So I played three of the sweetest 19th century ish numbers of Superstar that I could find, including the clothes. And when I got done, I looked at her and she said, see, it's blasphemous. Now you see what I mean by problem?
Well, you're taking some of the answers.
Oh, I've had that here too, last week, when we were involved with it.
I wish you'd call it your problem, rather than characterize somebody else.
I don't know what you mean by my problem.
What I thought
I don't have any personal problems with this at all.
What I'm trying to say is, if you could relate your own feelings as to what you're trying to put across, rather than identify the others what they are, what you think they are, what they think they are, you characterize it like that.
Now you're leaving me behind. I don't know what's going on.
Well, may I interrupt the next time I see you? Well,
maybe I have tried.
Yeah, okay, Paul.
Okay. There may be a few of us in this room. Who would like to hear your critique of Jesus Christ Superstar from the standpoint of aesthetics and from the standpoint of theology? And then, of course, after that, we will all know what Jesus Christ Superstar really is.
And you know good and well, Paul, you aren't going to get that.
You want to be a catalyst for this.
Yes, this is intended to be a kind of a forum. And, I would prefer to be a moderator and let Jesus Christ Superstar be the catalyst. It seems to be rather much of a catalyst in the country right now.
Don't you feel comfortable with
you
on the block?
Paul, that's where it usually is.
Oh.
Especially when you and I are together.
Has everyone listened to it in its entirety?
How many haven't?
I think it's kind of hard to start discussing until we have some common ground.
Well, we don't want to listen to Jesus Christ Superstar when we have an opportunity to listen to Bill Layman. We can listen to Bill Layman on and then enjoy him and listen to Jesus Christ Superstar.
I just can't really talk about it.
So would I.
I'm the first one to raise my hand.
Oh, right. Now we're going to discover who thinks they're young. That's 10 minutes.
I heard it. I don't even know how many times I've heard it. I've heard it too many times, but we know that I've set up to say a lot. And first time through, I couldn't understand it. Again, of course, the book comes with it. It has all the words and the characters and who's saying what and what they're saying. So then I sat down and paid attention and listened to it, and I loved it ever since. In fact, somebody said something about the ending to me, and I said, oh, is that right? I hadn't even realized that I just brought my own self to that, and, I didn't realize where they left off and I took up, you know. That it was an emotional appeal. It's not a musical form that I'm used to using, but I got used to it, and it kind of, you know, after hearing it a few times, I enjoyed it. And the more I listened to it, the more the emotional spoke to me in words. And, you know, it was a matter of paying attention to it, first of all, and really listening.
Cool.
Can I say something?
Sure.
Well, I would agree with people that a lot of it is kind of blasphemy, and a lot of it is mocking, but parts of it are really good, like,
can you specifically identify places that you feel are blasphemy or are mocking?
There's one part called Last Supper.
You want the book?
Yeah. It starts out pretty good, but then at the end, you know, it's the apostles kind of talking.
I think it's top of the right hand.
What is the
apostles? The setting is Maundy Thursday, the Last Supper.
Yeah, well, it says that they wanted to become apostles, so they could write books, so that everyone would talk about them, you know, after they die, and so they'd be, you know, famous and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of mocking. That's the only way
to follow these things. I think
that's
maybe
in
the beginning, maybe they did feel that.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So I
think I'm not here. You're kind of talking about John and James and wanting
to
know who's going to sit on the right hand?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, sir.
I think all the way through, Jesus seems to be talking to the apostles, but they don't really know what it's all about. They just think it's.
Right.
Yeah, you don't know. Some of the apostles maybe did react that way, you know. It makes them very real. The part I like is in Gethsemane, when Jesus is praying. The reason I like it so much is that it makes him, it shows that he really did suffer. You know, not wanting to take the cup, but, you know, it's your will, I'll do it. And it's the first time that I really understood how, you know, the blood and sweat and guts we went through.
Diana, this is an important remark you just made. You remember what you just said now? Can you say it again?
Well, it shows him suffering and really sweating it out for his decision, whether to, you know, die or not.
Do you notice any mood change in that solo? Is there any shifting emotions?
Oh yeah, totally, really, you know, crying out.
Do you recall? Would you like us to play that section?
I think it's good.
All right, let's talk a little bit more about it, and it'll give my girl Friday a chance to get set on it. It's the Gethsemane soliloquy. What's the mood with which it begins? What's his attitude?
He's saying, I only want to know why you think I should go through this. Why I should be, why, no, you haven't asked any other man, how come I should have to? He's saying.
Right, so it's a bit not understanding, it's a bit rebellious. Okay, then what happens? Mood-wise. I just roughly.
Well,
You're giving us program notes right now for those that haven't heard it yet, so they know what to anticipate. You're Miltona Cross right now.
But then he goes on to say, then there's the part where he says, see how I die, and it's really loud.
Pure rebellion.
Yeah. And then at the end he's given in and he says, God, thy will is hard, but you hold every card.
Okay. We'll do it your way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. And that's just a pretty good picture.
If there is a world,
I'm going
Particular selection were rewritten with identical notes, but the guitars were removed and you fit it symphonically. By the way, there was a symphonic backup here. I didn't know whether it was that in print. The guitars were close to mic so that they'd be featured. Yeah, if you rewrote the music for symphonic orchestra, and if you put one of the world's top operatic tenors on there, when that selection was done, you'd have everybody on their feet applauding wildly. I think one of the weaknesses, and I personally don't think there are a great many, and I'm talking aesthetically now, there are a great many weaknesses in Jesus Christ Superstar. But one of the pronounced weaknesses is the caliber of the singers. The music carries the singers. Singers don't carry music, and there's a great deal of delightful music in here which older people would think was tremendous if it was sung by good voices. Now, by the same token, this particular guy that was singing the Jesus Christ role does a very beautiful job near the end where he bridged the difference between music and talking, and he's just sort of talking softly to himself. You recall that section? You know, after the big turbulent section in the middle, and then there's a silence, and then he's given in, and he's talking very softly. And this is very real. I suspect that that great operatic tenor would have trouble with that particular section. You feel very real. Now, you feel rather uncomfortable with this kind of music. Two reasons. One, because it builds tension. It's got a lot of gut to it. And I didn't get understood last week when I talked about gut, so I hope I will today. But this music is put together in certain kind of places by means of repetition, by means of sounds grating against one another, by building intensity in a variety of kind of ways. It builds personal tension in you, the listener, and it's deliberately intended to, so that you can empathize easier with the character at that particular point in the production. Now, younger people are less, sensitive about being dealt with this way. They are less sensitive about being stimulated than older people are. Older people have grown up with the idea that one keeps one's emotions under control. And so we try to avoid kind of situations that would cause us to cry or to laugh uproariously or so on. We do this only under approved circumstances, you know, like weddings and funerals and things like that. And so consequently, something like this starts making us feel rather uncomfortable. And so we really got three alternatives. One is to figure out why it's making us feel uncomfortable, whether it's normal for us to feel that way, whether we're supposed to feel that way, and if so, what aesthetic reason is for it, and then maybe we get it all figured out, and then we like Jesus Christ Superstar from an aesthetic standpoint. Or we can get up and walk out, which some people did during that number. Or we can decide it's lousy and hate it and find all kinds of reasons why we don't. This kind of music, which is using a particular idiom that is in right now, it runs very heavily on the so-called affective aspect of learning. And as the young lady over here was pointing out before, what a number like this attempts to do is not only to tell you about something happening, but as best they can by the various media they're operating, give you a kind of a feeling, personal feeling of what it's like to go through that. In other words, it's kind of stereophonic from an emotional standpoint. You get involved in what's happening, you can feel it happening, and what she said is quite true, that one of the particular virtues of this particular selection is that perhaps for the first time in your life, you have a kind of feeling of what it must have really been like to have that kind of experience. Okay. Including, my God, my God, why hast thou forsaken
me?
But it's there in the gospel.
It's there, but it's not.
I think you're right and you're wrong on it, demonic. For this standpoint, because, yeah, I hate to even talk about that. On occasion, I preached on seven last words, and I always hated that one. Because at that particular point, you have the Son of God addressing his Father as my God. In other words, there's a complete divorce. God has forsaken himself. At that point, as is exhibited by what is said there. And God treats his Son as demonic. That's why I say you're right when you say it's demonic. But at the same time, you're wrong because it's God here who's suffering. But it's something that we just can't begin to understand. I suspect that this is why people, including, you know, these people try to do something with it musically to get at what it's all about.
Well, the music, I think, happens to me in the theater. It's just so hearing at this point why Allah and Christ has really given them death and what and how. And the question why has never come up. I'm sure we've said enough words, but when you get to the point, like you see, why has my God and my why has God forsaken me, it's something I can understand. Realizing that death is the final thing, death is death. That you die and I think it's me. It's not a mortality. But at this particular question, why he must go through this, that is the what he must
do. Yeah, well, the Garden of Gethsemane scene is very embarrassing for us, you know. It's all of a sudden, this guy who had all the answers falls apart. You know, all of a sudden we begin to think he may be human. And up to this point, you know, he has acted like a god. And it's got to be there so that we don't forget the human side of Christ's nature. I think a great many people get disturbed by superstyle because of the almost total emphasis on the human nature thing.
Could be written by agnostic designers.
It was written by two young men who were raised in the Church of England and are not professing members of the Church of England. Now, how much farther one can go than that, or whether it means anything about what's going on here, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know.
Hasn't this part been de-emphasized in, at least the Lutheran Church? I mean, looking at the Trinity, we emphasize the Son of God, but the Son of Man...
Well, this has usually tend to be the case in the whole history of Christian Church. I wouldn't limit it to Lutheran. For obvious reasons, because non-Christians are very willing to admit the human side of Christ and to reduce it to that. Considering the fact that this is a hunk of thing put together for commercial purposes by guys who were not putting it out in order to evangelize the world for Christ, there is an air of mystery about the Jesus figure, and there isn't a completely closed door even at the end. They can't write him off as just another guy. But they aren't willing to go, say he's God. Not to be the bit at all. Further comments, questions? Can you tell us a little more? Can you tell us why specifically?
I think it's from the other one. The guy in the was quite young. I really don't think he's from
him. He's no 33.
He's a 30-year-old man who was
living
very hard life.
Right. I discussed this a couple of months ago with a seminar that I had going with some. It was about 9 young people, most of them were males. 3 of them were in graduate school, the other ones were undergraduates. They were all quite bright, and most of them knew a great deal about music technically. Several were music majors. And we talked a little bit about this. They all liked it, by the way. They all liked it. And they all agreed that many of the characters sounded rather effeminate. They didn't really want to go all the way to saying effeminate. They were willing to settle for weak. But they felt that particularly the Jesus voice came across effeminate. Now, they were also willing to admit that having been brought up on the Bach tradition and all that, where the Jesus role is always sung by the guy with the big, rich, baritone voice, maybe they've been biased a bit. But they felt also that that it could have come across much better if there were a stronger, more mature voice in that role. I asked him about Judas, and he said he is far from a feminine. I thought there was time to. Hey, I don't know how to love him. That one?
Yeah,
I got a one here?
Yeah.
Okay. My girl Friday is looking it up. I got to tell you a little inside story. Called the other night, was it Tuesday night? Yeah, I think so. Tuesday night. A couple of our youngest young ladies sang for us at the beginning of Vespers. And the next morning, my oldest daughter came to me, and she had just gotten herself a new friend who had just arrived the day before, and he was about to depart the door, I noticed. They're both over there. Well, they came to me and wanted to know whether I thought it would be okay if they practiced together, and then tonight for Vespers sang, "I Don't Know How to Love Him." And I thought that was a rather cute little remark, and Mama and I knew this, said, "No, you know, that's what that's, you know, no appreciation." But I thought it was a rather interesting remark. I think it also reflects a little bit of what I called at the beginning the problem of Jesus Christ Superstar for different people. It's a, as you say, a lovely little melody. It's a beautiful expression of a woman's bewilderment who personally knew Christ and didn't quite know how to handle him because he didn't fit her turn. And it was a lovely melody, and they wanted to do it as an expression of joy in the Lord. And at the same time, my wife and I felt a little bit uncomfortable about it, apart from the fact that, you know, we don't feel that one should volunteer one service for that too. We prefer to wait to be asked. But anyway, we just didn't quite feel right about it. We all ready? Thank you. cries for a bigger voice than is on the recording there. Every time I played that in a general kind of a public area, and there was somebody around in the vicinity, there was music till they would start singing it. The other day I used that, last week I used that as the one for balancing the system over in Village Center, as best we could balance it to get the best quality out of the speaker system there. And the Norsemen were over there getting set to rehearse, and they had put down earphones. For the benefit of posterity, we just had a chip come down on the rug and call it being fired. They almost spontaneously started singing it. They had never sung it before, but they felt the need to improve on the way it was being sung. And with you have a feeling there's so much gut in the music, it's only beginning to be developed. You know, it's sort of like Sing Along with Mitch, with only Mitch singing.
Are you talking about a stronger voice?
A voice with more depth.
Yeah. Oh, it's hard for me to split hairs because I don't know that much about the technical part of the music, but I feel like a little mousy voice sometimes fits something because of the helplessness that she's emitting, or something like that. I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be a criteria of some voice necessarily fitting.
And a most feminine voice here, too, you see.
Yeah,
and a very strong woman's voice oftentimes, I think, leans toward the masculine, I mean, to the listener.
Let's try Lily Pond. Okay?
Try what?
Lily Pond.
Who's she?
You know, the greatest soprano of this century. She's been retired for about 10, 12 years now. She was about yay tall and magnificent, like the piano boy. The queen of grand opera.
Yeah, but you see, for the younger people, I don't think that when we talk about women as being, you know, who's your favorite woman star, some people would say someone like Janis Joplin, who has a real gutsy, gravelly voice.
I'm talking about who can get the most potentiality out of the role and the music that's there.
Well, what I'm trying to say is I think that in some ways, like I would agree with him, that it's almost in a folk idiom.
Yeah.
And hear a soft voice.
Yeah, but the thing is, what you don't know you can't really judge until you hear the other one too. I realize that.
Now, let me ask this question purely out of ignorance: has anybody else recorded any of this, or has it been held so tight by copyright that nobody else has been going to record it?
Yeah.
Have other people recorded it? Doesn't come across.
I agree.
Like Norman Luboff or Kuti.
No, there's several people who put it out and with much stronger voices, but
lost it?
I think so.
I mean, just the sort of voice has a certain sensuality about it.
Yeah.
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 Sensual.
Yes.
Along with you, you look at
it. All right.
And I think the interesting thing on that, especially
I'm glad
Norman,
I didn't tell my daughter she could sing it for me. She'd bomb.
With Norman's discussion of the Four of Loves, I think this is really great in that here I think Mary Magdalene was thinking along one line of love, and now she has to discover several others, and it's sort of hard to cope with, you know.
When it's happening to her and she doesn't know how to handle it.
Sure.
Right.
If she was thinking more of sexuality, and wow, now she has to, you know, grasp other concepts of love, not only, you know, the love of married marriage partners, but even beyond that, to love your Christ, wow, you know, the dimensions that he has to...
You know, if he could have had Meta and Manila thing there, because he did everything all the questions, that would have been kind of exciting. I don't know why we have to put him in camp to who agrees with. I think the content of the words itself is very belief. That's something about it. But we want to find out which is best. Yeah, let alone the one that the one is singing. What's best for somebody else? I think if somebody gets any meaning to the song, has any feelings for the words of the song, that's all right. But we always think I want to criticize what camp you belong to, what group you belong to, what you like, what you don't like. I think we should pick the words. And maybe it's meaningful to them to sing it. But if we want to find out that we couldn't get a viewpoint who and where you belong. I think if we have got some singing star to sing it, then we'll say, hey, you know, she sings it, I think that's all right. I like her anyway. That's a good song to put across. We'll sell more copies that way. We'll have more of a camp of that idea that...
Hey, but you're getting far, far removed from his credit.
To be honest with you, I don't quite understand the words.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about quality of performance, and we're talking about whether or not using this kind of a voice to portray this kind of a role, which is exhibited by this music in these words, is better way of doing it than using another kind of voice.
What I'm trying to say is that the Christ in the garden, with suffering and especially on him, pictures the individual as ourselves, the way we act under our own pressure. And if we're trying to put a pressure, how I should act, that's me. And how you should act, that's you under your pressure. And we're trying to analyze which way should we act.
I think he's got a good point there, Bill, that we could argue, we could play like we were music critics, you know, of the style. But I think he's suggesting here that maybe the substance is of more importance for us to be discussing than just the style, you know. I mean, we all have our own preferences for style, whether we're talking about liturgy or this. But what about the meaning of what the words say? I think this is more apropos.
Do you want to talk about the theology of Jesus Christ Superstar?
Speak as an elder statesman of the younger kids.
Give
him
five.
No, I don't know. No, I don't. I have experienced something. You know, I resisted listening to this because I heard, you know, that it was very secular and left out the resurrection. But after listening to it once, I discovered every time I went into my room, I was putting this record on, you know, in one place or another, and I developed my favorite things right away, you know, and this, to me anyway, it really brings across this human side, which you were talking about earlier, and I think that for me, I know that for me, that has real value, you know, and theologically, you know, I could tear into that thing, you know, even just with my very limited knowledge, and find holes in it. I really believe that I could, and I'm sure that someone more versed, you know, in theology could find all sorts of holes in there, things, places where maybe things have been left out or changed a little bit, you know, which, you know, you could argue with. But it's just one presentation, you know. I don't think that, I don't know, but I don't think a claim is being made for this that it's, you know, the only possible way of looking at Jesus Christ. But just one way, and it really comes across, for me anyway. And it's so good to hear some of those things put to music. That little speech about where the Pharisees said to him, you know, quiet your disciples down, you know, and he's coming into the city. He said, I tell you, if they were quiet, the very stones would shout. You know, now that's one of my favorite passages. And here it is to music. And it's, oh man, you know, I really dig that. And, you know, even the voice, just to get back to that thing, you know, even the voice of Jesus in this, I like. Precisely, I think, because it does sound young. And Christ, you know, being for the young, too, it, once again, you know, this is a question where aesthetics start to overlap with content. But I think that there's a real purpose, I mean, a real thing is served by having this voice be that way. In other words, it look at it either way, you know. Maybe someone else is going to react against it because of the use of it. And I react for it, you know. I like it. I think it's fine.
Well, I have to agree with you, Keith, that for me, before Jesus Christ Superstar was recorded and I heard it, Christ was more too much of a story. It was, you know, just the story. It nothing really spoke of a living Christ to me, you see. And wow, when I heard this, you know, I almost broke down in tears the first time I heard it, because it moved me so much that a man, but so much more than a man, you see. And I think that Christ's humanness is important to me as his godliness, you see, because that's the bridge. Oh no, I'm not trying to say, you know, an either or thing. I'm trying to bring it together, you see. See, I think we're so hung up on saying either this is good or this, you know. But that there's something here that I see is Christ's humanity as a bridge. Of course, this is my own theology, mind you, and I don't have any dogmas tacked to my wall or anything like that.
Okay, let's sort out several things here. Some people have to go back to work from the work school. Now, do what you want, Paul, now. Sort out several things from one another. One is dealing with this as an aesthetic object. The basic question is it a unity? Does it do successfully what it attempts to do? How does it hold together? And so on, which can be objectively debated, and where there is only one right answer. Secondly, you can talk about what theological position is being expressed by it. When you are concerned with this particular question, you can answer the question. You can support it by quotation. But you also have to bear in mind, since you're dealing with a work of art which purports to be musical drama, what you have to bear in mind is whose viewpoint is being expressed here. Number three, you can approach it from the standpoint of, is it or is it not of value to a Christian human being? And if it is of value, what value is it? Now, Bob's last remarks here were directed to the last section, which I indicated here. Let me try to give you some brief answers to the different topics that I set up here. If you want to continue farther, we'll be fine. We'll continue till 5, and we can play some other things if you like also. Number one, from the standpoint of work of art, for the benefit of you, those of you that were with us last week in the evening, we talked about Superstar. I'm a bit more optimistic about its future than Beanie is. I personally think, number one, that it's a complete fluke. And number two, that it is an excellent, from an aesthetic standpoint, that it's an excellent composition. It's been put together very well. the music and the language go very well together. I think that some of the music will probably, within 10 years, need to have footnotes to, some of the sentences will need to have footnotes to explain what it means. The problem you've always got when you write contemporary lines. But apart from that, I think it's got a lot of staying power to it. It's got a number of good lyrics to it. And it has very little dead wood in it. There are very few dead sections in it. And the whole thing carries quite well. So I think from an aesthetic standpoint, it's on the strictest aesthetic grounds, it's a perfectly respectable piece of music. And if somebody likes it, from a purely aesthetic standpoint, they've got no reason to be ashamed of the fact that they like it. In time, it may even get to be a classic. From a theological standpoint, I think that what it says is something like this. If I can find my notes. Life is very painful and confused. This is not only stated by the language, particularly by Judas Iscariot, but it also is done by the music. If those of you that are familiar with the music, at the very beginning, it begins relatively tranquilly, and then it begins to tighten up. And it tightens up tighter and tighter and tighter and tighter, and then all of a sudden we're into Judas. And it really winds you up very, very tight. The intent being to get you up tight, to give the idea of tension, confusion, and so on. Men do not know what God's purposes are, but they do seem to be aware of God. God uses us. We don't know what his reasons are. Finally, Christ speaks the answer about life, and his answer is that the only salvation which there is for man is to die. And he's not really sure about that. Now, there, in a nutshell, is the, we traditionally call, the theology. Now, I would be the last one to say you can reduce Jesus Christ Superstar to that. But that is the theological position. Which is rather unsettling, particularly when you like it and I like it. And it then raises the third question. By virtue of the fact that we are dealing with a drama here, we are not dealing with a theological doctrinal statement laid out sentence after sentence after sentence. We are dealing with an aesthetic unity here. Now, before I get on to the next question, let me throw in just a little aside here, and this is on the business of ending with death. Now, there are a lot of people that think that the lyric selection at the end is an intimation of the resurrection and so on. I personally think it's not. And I think it's not for aesthetic reasons. A drama, by its very nature, as a unified construction, has to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. It has to begin at some point, it has to build up to a tension, and that tension has to get a release, and then you're done. As a result of this, having killed your protagonist in your drama, you cannot bring him back to life again. This is bad theater. It just can't be pulled off. So if you are doing a drama, you got to kill him off in the end, right? Anybody knows anybody how you got to write dramas knows that that's the way it goes. Consequently, you cannot go beyond the death of Christ to get dramatic unity. In other words, you've got to do violence to what is the case and what was the case for the sake of your dramatic unity. Now, Bach faced the same problem. I mentioned last week Bach's St. Matthew's Passion, which also ends from a a story standpoint, from a narrator standpoint, with the death of Christ and with his burial in the tomb, same point at which Jesus Christ Superstar ends. It then is followed by a lullaby sung by the choir, by the whole choir and all the soloists. And they all sing together as a unity, a lullaby to the sleeping Jesus. The intimation being that when somebody sleeps, he's going to wake up. See? And this is the closest you come in the Passion according to St. Matthew by Bach to a statement of the resurrection. Now, you don't, I mean, we can talk about whether or not these guys believe in a resurrection or deliberately left it out and so on. See? But from a, you know, which is interesting discussion. But it doesn't solve any question about whether this, as an artistic composition, should have a resurrection in it or not. And I'm simply saying that from a purely technical structural standpoint, you can't put any in. You ruin your composition. You lose unity. Because resurrection is the beginning of a new life. As you know, that means several different things, has several levels of meaning. It also means a new line. And it's like introducing a new plot when you're at the end of the play. So you can't put it in. It's just not good dramatic writing. All right, now, so much about that. All right, now, we have a rather, let's say a rather, a very naturalistic, but a very cold and certainly hopeless viewpoint about existence, which is expressed in the theology of Superstar. So, this then causes us to raise the question, is this drama saying something about the nature of life, or is this drama showing us a view of reality as it might have been of one of the characters in the drama? And this is why last week, Wednesday night, I suggested at the end of the evening, suppose that this is written from the standpoint of Judas Iscariot. And that what we are getting here is an artistic effort to show Jesus Christ the way that Judas Iscariot might have seen him and thought about him. Reflecting not God's truth and reflecting not God's values, but reflecting Judas Iscariot's values and the way he saw them. And as you look at the various items which are picked out by the authors, and I'm just going to make a case for it, not a case against it. But as you pick, if you look at the various items which are selected by the authors, you find Judas, who is the guy that maintains the continuity. He's the guy that explains to you what's going on. Right? There's one hunk of evidence. Number two, we have the anointing of Jesus' feet by the woman with costly perfume, an anointing which Judas criticized. Now, certainly one can make out a bit of a case for this on the grounds that, what did he say about her anointing? He said that it was for his burial. See, so it could have some relationship to the Passion story. But it's kind of a remote relationship, but it is important from the standpoint of Judas. Because Judas is the guy here who comes off as the heavy and who is critical of what this woman did. And is important in the Passion story only if we are concerned about Judas. There are a couple items that you got to take on faith, like what happened at the Last Supper as the words of institution were given. Well, we've never been able to establish whether or not Judas was there. Some of the Gospels, the way they are written, would suggest that he was there and partook of the sacrament. At least one of the Gospels, I think, can be interpreted in such a way that he wasn't there. I think our human wishes are that he wasn't there. It could go either way. But I think if you view it in this way, what you are getting... And the lady that was sitting over here made the remark about the demonic. What you are getting is a kind of a demonic gospel. And I'm using the word gospel in the sense of life of Christ. you know, rather than theological tenets of gospel. Maybe I should say you're getting a demonic version of the passion. And a demonic version of the passion can be very valuable also. I think one of its primary values is that what it tends to do is to highlight the humanness of people. I think another thing that the demonic tends to do is to highlight pain, suffering, hopelessness, and things of this sort. And certainly there's that dimension to life that we've got to be aware of also. So, in brief and in the end, I think that this is a composition which is, from an artistic standpoint, quite respectable. This is one of many remarkable things I think about it. And I think it is also something that we can, with value, discuss. I would certainly not want anyone to think that now that we have Jesus Christ Superstar, we can now burn our Bible. Because it's not a substitute for the Bible. But what it tends to do is to do certain things for us. And we oftentimes tend to forget that. And this is one of the role of the arts, that what the arts tend to do is to broaden us, to sensitize us, to give us new ideas, new visions, and so on, and to fill out in many kinds of ways the concepts which we already possess. And this being the role of the arts, I think that this has done something. I would say it has done a much better job than any of the Bible epics that C.B. DeMille used to turn out, and we used to take our whole congregation to see. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like how Moses created the world, you know, and all those things. See, they were, I don't think they were even aesthetically respectable. So I think that this particular composition stands head and shoulders above that and can be put to very good use. And I think the fact that it gets a response from a great many young people who are having difficulty responding to many other things is all in its favor also. Okay, that's the formal end. Now we can informally go on. I mentioned, for the benefit of people that came in later on, I mentioned that I had asked Rosie to bring over her copy of a composition which was done by these same two men before they did Jesus Christ Superstar. And in case you were interested in listening to it, would she bring it over? And she tells me it's about half hour long. And I always forget the title, but Bob doesn't.
What is it? Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat or something?
Yeah, it's the story. It's the same kind of a treatment, but it's the story of the Old Testament figure Joseph. She also brought a number of copies of the Word, so I'm open to my girl Friday back there playing that for you if you'd like, or we can play more of Superstar, or we can talk. Did Rosie leave it?
I think your wife took it.
My wife took it?
Yeah.
Well, that's what happens when one doesn't talk to one's wife. So we can talk further, or we can disband, or whatever you'd like.
The other night, did you play anything with regard to Judas? Yeah. And, you know, last week.
I don't recall. I don't think we did. I think we played just a little piece, little section to near the end. Judas' speech near the end.
Oh. Leads into the Superstar.
Right, it's a section just before Jesus Christ Superstar, before that theme.
That's right. You know, I keep thinking of, see, we were at Holden, our village, in 69.
Yeah.
After we went back, I was so tired of draggy thongs in our church. And so I teach 10th and 11th graders.
Oh.
And so I got an interested bunch together. I took back Norm Hobble's for Mature Adults Only.
Right.
With that as tools, I tried to get them inspired so that maybe they could, if I could be a liaison type of person, to get them going on trying to make a more contemporary worship service.
Oh.
But the thing that the pitfall is this beat thing. And even though I love it, I mean, it seems like it really turns a lot of Lutherans off. And they say that the reverence and the seriousness and everything is the, I guess, the majority rules, but that's what's so important in a worship service. And,
Sure. If I just cut in on you here a second, don't forget what you're going to say next.
Well, no, just let me end
okay.
this one.
All right.
The thing is, I find that when you listen to some contemporary music, whether it's worship, sacred or secular type of music, the beat sometimes overshadows, it's kind of like upstaging the words.
Hmm.
And so I think that there has to be a delicate balance here between beat and...
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And, you can get carried along by the beat.
But I don't think this overdoes the beat.
They were very careful.
Well, it's not only that. It's not only that, but we're getting, once again, at the point where Bob and I were tangling last time, and that is you are getting the same thing going on in a great many places here subverbally that you're getting happening verbally. In other words, the music and the words are matched, beautifully matched, and it's going on subvocally at the same time that it's going on vocally, so that you can feel it. Now, in Norm's things there, you had ideas that the catchy music and catchy beats.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. And there wasn't necessarily a synchronization.
Would it be considered sacrilegious instead of going, holy, 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 and you go, holy, 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 you know, like that? Would that be considered...
The blacks, gracious, listen to their gospels. I mean, yes, they're swinging, you know?
Yeah.
And
but
I don't
would this
think
turn too many people off so it would be not a worship...
They're turned off by style, I think,
yeah.
To start with, and the style negates their listening for the substance. And it's, you know, and I think it's a two-way street,
yeah.
Which is unfortunate. You know, kids always say, well, my parents won't listen to this, but the kids are just as... In many instances, just as bullheaded or as narrow-minded as,
yeah.
You know. Yeah, but oftentimes in the same treatment, it doesn't work. I went to a Lutheran student center up in Bemidji. We took our students up there for a Sunday worship service, and they tried to integrate the red hymnal with folk songs,
yeah.
And the whole thing was a disaster because,
you just feel
they pulled each other apart rather than augmented each other.
Now there's we always have a tendency to sanctify folkways. I like to remind myself every once in a while. Of a passage in the Old Testament where it says, and David got up and danced before the altar. Yeah, I can imagine there was many an Israelite there that day that kind of said, gee, I wish Saul was still alive. Look at this guy, you know. How did God ever see him as king? Even though dancing was, an accepted form of a medium of worship among
the Israelites.
Yeah,
but did they have close body contact?
I thought that question had been settled once, but it hadn't. Well, there's still hope for America then.
Yeah.
Why don't they tie the patriotic idea with the song? You know, you can get some kind of nationalist songs that you can take the beat of it and put it into there. You'll probably get a big, strong, willing to fight for the cause of
sure you can. I recall who was it that said it. Maybe Bob, you ran across this same remark. But somebody once made the comment that Napoleon would not have been a great man had Le Marseillais not been written.
Well, that recruited more soldiers to the French flag. You know, who wants to fight for the Star Spangled Banner? You can't even sing it. And
the point, the point was made more earthy by Tom Lehrer, you know, in the song We Are the Folk Song Army. Yeah. You know, that, and you think about it, the best songs are written by the people who generally, quote, win the war. In other words, Vietnam has blown, I mean, it's nothing. I mean, nobody really thinks that America has succeeded. All the great songs are anti-war songs.
Yeah.
I mean, the Ballad of the Green Beret has been discredited aesthetically as well as, you know, on every plane. And yet there are some excellent, you know, anti-Vietnam War songs, which I mean, going along with this, that Napoleon and the Marseillaise.
Yeah, no, one of the primary, I think one of the primary weaknesses of the Johnson administration was the failure to try and find Irving Berlin. Probably just as great, if not a greater, tactical mistake than somebody else wants to do. Because they never, and I'm talking sheer strategy, you know, not right and wrong, but sheer strategy. If you want to get your nation to back the war you want to get them into, there's certain things you got to do. And one of these is that you've got to have songs that the people love to sing that march them up to the front lines and fight. And
but they're rarely constructed in the studio.
Bob.
See,
right, but we didn't get any Korea either.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then they could use the older songs. I mean, from
But can you imagine singing Over There?
I wouldn't doubt if it, I mean, I sang it when I was
We're starting to get into tonight's topic now, which
to be,
I'm going
to be
leading.
The only thing I've ever heard about Korea is that disease is gone to Korea.
I don't think Korea even spawned any dirty songs. Anybody, in Korea, you know, the only ones that know the dirty songs are the veterans. And I wasn't a veteran of Korea, and certainly not of Vietnam. I don't think they even got any dirty songs, did they?
I don't know. But, well, Lehrer, of course, I think he was using the Spanish Civil War as his example.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you know, it is an interesting point, though. The importance of music in the direction of, I'll say, a movement of people, because we can't say a nation, but a strong movement of people. They need songs to, you know, songs that they can relate,
right?
Communicate a certain ideal.
Yeah, John Dewey made it, I'm sure, this quote. John Dewey made the comment, let anybody who wants write the nation's ideas, let me write the nation's songs.